This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hi, I'm Dave King. This is The North This Week. A big week. A very big week for one man in Fort Smith in the Northwest Territories. This week, Barclay Heron became a multimillionaire. He won half of a $22 million Lotto 649 jackpot. And guess how this Métis businessman decided to celebrate? He found a way to share some of his good fortune with his customers. Heron operates a cab company, convenience store, and gas station. And the night he won the lottery, he dropped the price of gas from $1.15 down to 50 cents. Word spread pretty quickly throughout Fort Smith, and a lineup stretched for blocks until the pumps finally ran dry around 2:30 in the morning. CBC's Patty K. Hamilton dropped by for a quick chat with Heron the next morning as he filled up again.
We lowered our gas prices to 50 cents a liter just to help people in Fort Smith, and because of all the support they gave us over the years, and to thank them that they supported our businesses for years, and we hope that they'll continue supporting our businesses. So we got a large turnout. There's a lineup for a couple of blocks.
Now there's a sign on the pumps right now that says no gas. Did you actually empty your tanks?
Yeah, we had them filled up yesterday, and by this morning we emptied the last of it this morning, about 10,000 liters.
Barclay Heron won $11 million in the lottery last weekend. Congratulations, Barclay. You're listening to The North This Week. More than 1,300 people gathered in Hay River this week to remember the RCMP constable who was shot and killed there recently. Constable Christopher Warden's wife, Jody, spoke during the memorial service, and here's some of what she had to say.
To all those in attendance today, I wish to say thank you. Thank you for welcoming us into your community. Thank you for giving Chris the opportunity to make a difference. Thank you for attending today and showing us how he touched your lives in a positive and memorable way. It is tremendously empowering to see how the strength of a community that pulls together to face a tragedy can help lessen the pain of losing an incredible husband, father, brother, son, uncle, officer, and friend. I have received countless cards and calls from community members asking if there is anything they can do for Alexis and I. There is. Firstly, remember. Remember Chris. Talk about him to others. Tell your stories. If we talk about him, he will continue to live through us. By talking about Chris, you will make it easier for me to help Alexis remember her wonderful daddy. Secondly, and this is really important, help make the jobs of the remaining detachment members in Hay River easier. They are the pillars of this community, and support them. If you see something that's wrong, that looks suspicious or questionable, call them. Every bit of information helps to put pieces of the puzzle together. Drugs are a terrible problem in this town, but the police can't do anything, nothing without your help. Chris died because of the illegal drug trade. Please don't let his death go without meaningful consequences. We need to do something right as a result of this devastating wrong. Each of us, every one of us, can change this part of Hay River by protecting one another and giving the police information to help them tackle this growing problem. I need to thank the RCMP and their staff for the incredible support that our family received both in Hay River and in Ottawa. Keith, Bill, Pat, Brent, Greg, Dan, all of Ottawa Police Services. Without your support, I don't know where we would be right now. To all of the investigators on this case, thank you for your tireless and continued efforts. It gives me some peace of mind to know that you are doing your job well and someone will be held accountable for taking Chris from us. Know that you have made your brother proud and served him well. I received an email from a former colleague of Chris's who said that, quote, from now on, no member will ride alone. Chris will always be with us. It is my hope that each member of the RCMP, especially all those who worked closely with Chris, can take comfort in knowing this as they live on to serve and protect. I would like the residents of this town to know that while Hay River is the place where we tragically lost Chris, I will fondly remember it more for its nutritious soil for gardening, the abundance of pickerel in the river, the day trips to the falls, the beautiful northern lights, the friends that we had met, and the community that had embraced us. But most of all, I will remember Hay River for the place where Chris and I welcomed our beautiful Alexis into the world. In closing, I would like to honor the memory of my husband and the job he loved dearly by saying a prayer for the RCMP. Almighty God, who has called men and women to your service for the protection of your people and for the maintenance of your right, we beseech your blessing upon the commissioner, officers, members, and employees of this force. Endue them with loyalty and courage, and grant that wherever they may be called to duty or danger, they be under your protection. Amen.
That was Jody Warden speaking at a memorial service for her husband, Constable Christopher Warden, last weekend. There is some new information about the events leading up to Warden's death. The information is contained in a 24-page document put together by RCMP. They used it to get a search warrant for the home in Edmonton where Warden's suspected killer was finally arrested. CBC reporter Richard Gleason spoke to Randy Henderson this week about the new information.
First of all, talk a bit about where this information came from.
Well, as you mentioned, Randy, it comes from a document police compiled to get a search warrant. When Bulacci was arrested, police wanted to search the house where he was found. To do that, they needed to convince a judge or a justice of the peace that that search was necessary. So this is Yellowknife RCMP Corporal Michael Lesage's summary of what eight other police officers who investigated the shooting told him.
So what did the other police officers tell Corporal Lesage?
Well, at 5:03 in the morning of October 6th, police got a call that a man had threatened to kill himself. Constable Warden arrived at the man's house 20 minutes later but didn't find him there. At 5:31, Warden radioed in that he was leaving there and going to 55 Woodlands Drive. That's the last anybody heard from Constable Warden. At 6:30, the dispatcher contacted another Hay River RCMP officer saying Constable Warden was not answering his radio. Another officer arrived at 55 Woodlands and saw Warden's vehicle and noticed that no lights were on at 55 Woodlands. Other officers joined the search. Warden was found just before 8 o'clock in a small stand of trees about 200 meters from his vehicle. He had gunshot wounds to his neck, abdomen, and chest. He was pronounced dead at the hospital 30 minutes later.
What did the witnesses say happened?
Well, there were interviews with eight witnesses who saw something that day or that night. Three of them were in 55 Woodlands that Friday, the day before Warden was shot. Two of them say that they saw a young man there known that they know as Justin. He arrived in the afternoon with two other men. The three had a new video game system. They played video games in a ground floor bedroom at the house until early in the morning. The witnesses say about an hour before the three men left, Justin reached into his pocket to get some money and they saw a silver handgun in the waistband of his pants. Another witness, who says the three stayed at his place when they weren't at 55 Woodland, says he had heard that the three had a Glock, which is a 9mm handgun.
Who were these three men?
Well, police believe Justin, who witnesses described as a short, stocky man with a round face, police believe he's Emra Bulacci, the man accused of murdering Warden. And Randy, you've probably seen photos of Bulacci. He fits this fairly vague description that witnesses have given. He is a short man, kind of chubby, has a round, babyish-looking face. Two witnesses say that the three men are crack cocaine dealers.
Richard, were there any witnesses to the actual shooting?
Well, three people saw Warden arrive at 55 Woodlands as the three were about to leave in a taxi. They saw one man run away and an RCMP officer give chase. The driver of the taxi says the officer asked one of the three, a man with a round face, put his hands on the back of the cab. But as the officer was about to search him, the man took off and ran behind the singles apartments. The cab driver says that moments later, he heard four gunshots. His passengers, the two other men, told him to drive away at that point. Another witness says Justin was the one who ran away. The witness heard three or four gunshots and saw a man's head snap back and saw the man then fall limp to the ground. And yet another man saw a man he later described as Bulacci running from the area immediately after the shooting.
So, Richard, what's next in this case?
Well, Randy, just to reemphasize something I mentioned at the beginning, all of this information I've talked about is taken from interviews police did in the days after the shooting. None of it has been proven or checked for the truth of it. That's something that's going to happen as the case winds its way through the courts. The man accused of the murder, Emre Bulacci, is presumed innocent. Right now, as I mentioned, he's being held at the North Slave Correctional Center. He was arrested by police in Edmonton 6 days after the shooting. When he first appeared in court, he didn't have a lawyer. He's due back in court on December 13th, and he has a right to ask for a bail hearing anytime before then as well.
Thanks a lot for this, Richard.
You're welcome, Randy.
Reporter Richard Gleason and host Randy Henderson are both with CBC North in Yellowknife. You're listening to The North This Week. I'm Dave King. Remember school picture day? A collared shirt under your good sweater? Or your favorite little dress? Your mom licking her thumb and rubbing at some stubborn spot on your cheek? And then sitting up straight, hands in your lap, flashing your biggest grin? And as you got older, waiting with bated breath to see how those photos turned out? Well, last week, Yellowknife students made their annual trip in front of the camera. And Kirsten Murphy dropped by to visit.
When you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
when you're smiling,
an old world smiles with you, and when you're laughing.
There we go.
Keep your eyes on the lens there, and a little bit more if you can. Okay, and you got a nice smile for your girlfriend there? There it is, okay. And that's it, you're all done. Okay, who's next? You guys can come on a little closer here. Okay, she's got the right idea there, but does she have the smile? Where'd that smile go I saw? Okay, and there's the smile. And that's it, you're all done.
I didn't smile, okay.
I'm wearing skinny jeans. A t-shirt, like a long sleeve t-shirt. Ask her.
Did you guys call each other up? You're looking pretty similar.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. We got like straightened our hair and stuff. We tried on like a million pairs of clothes too.
He made me smile. I was like,
I didn't know it was picture day today. But I did wear a nice shirt anyway.
So I want you to keep your eyes on this blue circle here when I take the picture. You have a smile. There's that smile right there. Okay, and that's it.
It's Talon Christensen. It feels like I am 50 Cent. No. It feels like I'm just getting my picture taken.
Do you have a girlfriend?
All right,
no.
Are you going to give any of your pictures out to girls?
No. Because I'm too embarrassed.
James Bassett. I just got up, put on my usual clothes. And
now, styles changed. I think 10 years from now, you might look back and go, oh my goodness, why did I wear that?
Yes, it'll just be like your parents looking back at the 70s. Yes, it will, probably.
Okay, I need to concentrate on the
lens. My name is Terrence Chambers. Yeah, photographer slash manager slash trainer, so... Yeah, people don't dress up as much as they used to. They don't take it as serious as it was before. So, you know, a lot more hats than there used to be and bandanas and stuff like that. So,
what's the cheekiest thing you've ever seen a student do?
One guy asked me if he could take his shirt off for the picture. I've also had a couple just turn around and do the back of their head.
And then do you ask them to resit?
Oh, of course, yeah. You get all kinds. It's, I find the kids have a little more respect up north than possibly down south. It's, I don't know. It all depends. There's certain schools up north too that, you know, you're gonna always have your occasional bad kid. So it happens.
Well, my name's Paul Heinrichs. Just sometimes there are kids just want to smile when they come, but I actually find that most people don't really like photo days. So I don't know. I really couldn't say. I don't know why kids don't like photo days. They get a little less.
It's different in elementaries. They're excited that you're there, and high schools, it's, you know, they're coming into adulthood, so it is almost a chore just to come to photo day. We have a little more fun in elementaries because we'll sometimes joke around and give them fake names like SpongeBob and Barney, and we do the old high five on the way out kind of thing with the littler kids. And, you know, they're laughing on their way to the camera, and they're laughing when they leave.
John McCarroll. I wear something with a tie. And the suspenders tie.
And what?
Suspenders.
Oh, suspenders. Okay.
And this is a suspenders tie, and that's my thing. I had it all at home, you know. I have lots and lots of toys and lots of clothes. I picked it out.
Once you get your photos back, who do you give them to?
You.
You are sweet.
I have cords on mine. My name is Evan, and this is white, blue, and the pants.
And then what does the photographer say?
He gives me a picture, and he gave him a high five, and he says, "Get out of here." It's so funny.
Here it is. This one's for Princess Fiona. Nice one. 25.
My name is Brent Jones, and I'm a photographer for Life Touch Canada. For kindergartens, you have to really, you just change the way you goof around with them. It's a different kind of goofiness. Kindergartens, you just do stuff like the high five and ask them if they brought their smiles with them today or if their smiles are in their pockets. And then as you get older, we start nicknaming the kids, and they think that's just the funniest thing on earth. Since they get older, they think it's not very cool anymore to smile or get a nickname. So basically, you got to go in and be a kid. So it's awesome. I really like this job. I really like it.
Hey, Martha. Watch your feet there.
That's Martha. That's great.
You guys can come right back here. Right after this.
Yellowknife students and their thoughts on Picture Day. Kirsten Murphy put that together for us. Thanks for that piece, Kirsten. This is the North This Week. Delegates from across the northern coast of this continent are in Alaska this week to talk about what's happening to their homes. Or, in the case of Nunavut, what might happen to their homes. We all know global warming is melting the ice caps, but it's also melting the ice beneath our feet, the permafrost. Not so permanent anymore, apparently. When the permafrost melts, the ground caves in. It's that simple. So if your home, indeed all the homes in your community, happen to be built on permafrost, you can see why you might be worried. And people in Nunavut's coastal communities in particular are. Places like Clyde River on the northeastern coast of Baffin Island. That's where Nick Eidlout is from. He's at the Northern Housing Conference in Alaska to find out what can be done to prepare homes and structures in the north for global warming. Nick spoke to CBC's Lizzie Anaviapik earlier this week.
Now, Nick, you're obviously concerned about this. How do you think it will affect the housing situation in Nunavut?
As one example, Alaska already has a plan set aside to relocate a whole town or a whole set of towns, and the price tag isn't cheap. Nunavut gets approximately $1 billion a year to operate, but in Alaska, to move three or four communities, it's going to cost $150 billion to $15 billion just to relocate, and this is due to the permafrost degrading within the town, so they have to move to a new part. I can imagine seeing something like that happening in Nunavut in the next 10 to 20 years, where the coastal communities are sinking or the permafrost has degraded so much that the buildings that people live in Nunavut get wrecked so much that they just get abandoned or condemned or something. Like most people in Nunavut see their houses and see cracks on the drywall or on the floor, and the floor is warping. And you can see that everywhere in the Arctic, and to fix that, it's very expensive. You have to redo the foundation and so on. I'm trying to get a good sense of what needs to be done before that starts happening so we can make a good plan for all of Nunavut, maybe even avert all the expensive charges that comes with relocating towns.
Now, this sounds like a long-term goal. What other things will you be talking about at the meeting?
There's going to be a section for alternative energies. I mean, the municipality of Clyde River has a big ambition of going green in the near future. And since the price of gas and diesel has just been announced that it's going to go up another 10 cents, we don't like that sort of outcome for the future. It's going to keep going up and making our lives more miserable by spending more on this and that. We need to find a good answer or alternative or radical answer of fixing this expensive gas fuel. We have to find ways of using local resources such as the sewage lagoon, convert that to hydrogen, or the dump as a good energy source by steam incineration, or windmills are good for Clyde River and many other communities within Nunavut that have a lot of wind, or currents from the ocean, or many other options. But the direction that Nunavut government has taken towards alternative energies is not all that great. They'll have to revert rivers so that they can create hydro dams and create electricity that way. But that creates problems for people who hunt or fish in that region, people who use that route to travel or go camping. Instead of affecting that much of the environment, why not just go towards wind power or solar energy or other means of creating electricity? I think for the future, or for everybody in the whole world, that will be one of the main objectives, since we're destroying our own Earth.
Now, Nick, what do you hope to accomplish from the meeting?
Since this conference is about infrastructure challenges in the Arctic, I'm going to try to lobby the organization that I'm going to meet with to do research in Clyde River. Let's say we got one building erected, froze the ground fast, and then thawed it out real fast to see what sort of warping and other experiments we can do to make housing better and more suitable for the future. We have an ambition to do a lot of research regarding our region, and we want to create an industry in Clyde River, more like an academia or academic studies regarding our region and other future prospects that are much better than what we've been planned for already. If the industry or the governments are not doing it, then the only choice is for the small communities to start the initiative so that once it starts, the government can see an example and see, yeah, it can be done, and maybe this is the direction we should be facing for the future. I'm trying to influence small communities or communities within Nunavut plus the governments that this sort of planning is essential for Nunavut for the future.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Nick Eitlout from Clyde River, Nunavut. He was speaking with CBC's Lizzie Anaviapik. My name is Dave King, and you are listening to The North This Week. Thousands of Northerners may lose their right to vote in the next federal election. They're among more than 1 million rural voters affected by changes to the Canada Elections Act. An amendment to that act now requires voters to show ID with a municipal address before voting. And if all you've got is a P.O. box, you're out of luck. Dennis Bevington is the Member of Parliament for the Western Arctic. He spoke to CBC's Sandy Coleman this week about these changes.
Mr. Bevington, I'd like to know when this change came about and how it came about.
Well, last year, the Conservatives brought forward Bill C-31, which is a photo ID bill, which was going to require all Canadians to show photo ID before they could vote in any federal election. This, you know, was, of course, an issue of some concern to northern people because we have a fairly large percentage of our population, especially in remote and isolated communities, that don't have photo ID. As part of this package, they had, within the legislation that they struck, which was eventually passed through the support of the Liberals and Conservatives in the Bloc, with our party in, opposing it, when the legislation was struck, included in it was the requirement that the photo ID have municipal street addresses attached to it or on it. And this has turned out to be a real problem because it's clear that many, many Canadians don't have street addresses. And we need to see now a change to the legislation. We're still very concerned about the nature of the legislation as it stands. And we'll be trying to ensure when they do bring this forward for revisions that we can look at ways of making it less onerous on northerners, to with their right to vote.
So is it a case of the lack of address or the lack of identification that's the problem, or both, a combination of both?
Well, I think there's a combination of both here. There's about 15% of Canadians that don't have proper photo ID. And our problem in Canada is not, I think our biggest problem in Canada is apathy towards voting, and the numbers show that we're consistently under 60% of the population that actually votes. We're going to make it difficult for another 15% of the population to vote this next time. They're going to have to get proper ID, or if they don't have the ID, they can still get sworn. They can still vote, but it will require two people on the voting list, on that particular poll's voting list, that will swear for them that they're, properly entitled to vote in that area. And those two people will only be able to do that once for anybody. So it's not a question of the polling clerks being able to do this. You know, if somebody doesn't have photo ID, they're going to have to bring two people with them that can swear to their their proper place on the voting list.
So, as you mentioned, it wouldn't be a complete impossibility for someone not to be able to vote next time.
But it's going to cause great confusion, and these sorts of things are going to lead to less people voting.
Well, why would the change necessary in the first place?
Well, and I really question that as well. We've had four cases of voter fraud in the last four federal elections. So that's out of the probably 50 million votes cast. There's only been four cases of voter fraud that have went forward to the courts. You might make the argument as well that this could be a social conditioning effort on the part of the government, getting us used to providing our identification for every purpose under the sun. And what a better place to start than with the voting.
Do you have any idea why there was such an urgency to get it through at the time that it's gone through?
Well, I think both the Liberals and Conservatives were because they recognized that this was a highly controversial issue that they weren't going to win on. They preferred to get it through committee and voted and passed as quickly as possible in Parliament. It's now we're in a difficult situation. If an election was held tomorrow, we would either have to go with the existing rules or try to get some kind of special dispensation through the electoral officer, there's going to be a great deal of confusion at the polls. We need to get this straightened out, and we need to ensure that the main goal with our electoral laws is to encourage people to vote. That's the biggest problem we have in the voting system today.
Well, you mentioned being ready when they did bring it for revision. Is there any sign of that on the horizon?
Well, certainly the House leader for the Conservatives indicated last week that they were going to come up with some kind of answer. We haven't seen it yet. we think there's some real difficulty in the answers that they're looking for. And one of the amendments that we wanted to put forward last time was to allow statutory declarations. In other words, if someone doesn't have photo ID or doesn't, they can sign a statutory declaration indicating, you know, that they are a voter resident in that area and that they're entitled to vote.
Any idea how many people this would affect across the north?
Well, people without street addresses in Nunavut are 80%. Without the same numbers, it's about 27% in the Northwest Territories, and I think it's 17% in the Yukon. The percentage of people without photo ID right now, I think, ranges across the territory at a level that's at least as high as the figure for Canada, probably higher.
Mr. Bevington, you do mention it that it's a right. I mean, the Charter protects people's right to vote. Is there a chance that this part of the law might be challenged by someone out there?
Well, you know, that's, you know, you hate to have that happen because you want to pass laws that are compatible with our Charter. And I would hope that in the end that we can come up with something, you know, that will work for people and will be, you know, fit with our basic rights.
Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, take care.
Dennis Bevington is the Member of Parliament for the Western Arctic. This is The North This Week. I'm Dave King. Thanks for being with me. The mines may be booming over in the Northwest Territories, but times are a little tough for tourism operators there. The Canadian dollar is too high to attract a lot of Americans, and caribou quotas are too low to accommodate a lot of hunters. So one enterprising tourism operator is exploring a new opportunity to bring in some bucks. Gary Jabe is the owner of True North Safaris, and he runs McKay Lake Lodge. He helped out with the production on the popular History Channel show Ice Road Trucker, and that gave him an idea. CBC's Randy Henderson spoke to Jabe this week.
Now, I know you were involved in the Ice Road Trucker series. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that, first of all.
Well, we hosted the production crew, the cameramen, up at McKay Lake Lodge, and we provided drivers for them, like in 4x4 pickup trucks, following the big rigs that they were filming. And we did that for all of February and most of March.
So while you were doing this, Gary, at what point did you realize that, you know, you might have potential here for a spin-off business?
Well, we'd actually been thinking about it for a couple of years, and like, we haul our own supplies up the ice road, and we've had friends wanting to come along and that sort of thing, and we just, our summers are too short and our winters are long, so this really motivated us, this Ice Road Trucker series, to look at developing a product that we could market.
And who primarily would be interested, do you think, about traveling down an ice road?
Well, we're going to market in North America, you know, Canada and U.S. mainly, but I think there may be some interest in some of the Asian countries. But I don't know, it seems to be all different generations. I've had some inquiries from, you know, retired school teachers, for example, or young people who are more adventurous. And for some reason, there seems to be a whole lot of interest. I always think of, like, sand beach in a hot climate for a winter vacation, but there are folks that want to come and see the Arctic and see the winter.
So how would these tours work, Gary?
Well, we're just, you know, going to pick people up in Yellowknife or put them up in hotels and then pick them up and drive up the ice road to McKay Lake Lodge. It's about a 6-7 hour drive, depending, and stop for photo opportunities, and we see wildlife along the way, and, you know, caribou, foxes, wolves sometimes, and this, the Arctic landscape, and then spend the night at McKay Lake Lodge and do some aurora viewing if we can, and we've got a nookshooks there in the Arctic landscape, and then the next day drive up to the Divic mine site and back to the lodge, you know, second night back at the lodge and then back to Yellowknife, but it's always looking for photo opportunities, and we'll have snowmobiles, and when we have extra time in the evenings, go for snowmobile rides, and so it's, you know, two nights, 3 days, and it's, you know, driving there one day and driving back the third day and going through a mine in between. So
now, I understand you're giving people the chance to talk to the ice road truckers while they're out there. Did you have any trouble convincing the truckers to play along?
Not really. Most of the guys are friendly, and in fact, it's a long, boring trip for them because they're only allowed to drive, you know, 15, 20 kilometers per hour on the big lakes. But we have LAD radios, so we can monitor their talk. And the main channel is more for safety and emergencies. So if we want to talk to somebody, we'll ask them to flip to, say, Channel 3 and then just talk. We get guys from all over the world, actually all over Canada. They're driving these trucks, and that's interesting.
How much interest have you had so far?
Well, we're getting calls. I've just, I think we decided to try and build on the publicity from that Ice Road Trucker television series, and I did a little ad with the CTC News here a few days ago, and I've gotten probably a dozen calls since then. So I'm still sort of pondering what kind of an advertising program I'm going to have, but just having the Ice Road Trucker as part of my search engine on my website is helpful.
So what do you think there is about this, Gary, that appeals to people?
Well, it's the longest ice road in the world. I mean, and the diamond mines are a big thing of interest in themselves. And the winter in the Arctic, driving to the Barren Lands. You know, we literally drive from the trees in Yellowknife into the Barren Lands, so you see the transition. And the aurora is awesome. Well, here too, but in the Barren Lands more so. It's the wildlife. It's the whole intrigue of the Arctic and diamonds. And I think this Ice Road Trucker now, that series has created a whole new sort of the danger of the ice road and things like that, which is not really dangerous. But we follow like all the protocols and safety things when we communicate with the security people and we always give way to the big rigs and stuff like that. So it's not just, we're not trying to encourage people just to go driving up the ice road without giving it a lot of thought and you know, staying with the protocols that have been developed for the road. But it's all of that, the adventure.
Yeah. So how important would this aspect of your business be? Because I know you're an outfitter as well, and some outfitters are struggling because of the caribou quota reductions and you know, the high Canadian dollar and this sort of thing. This is filling a niche as far as your business is concerned too, eh?
Well, it is, yes, absolutely. It allows us to operate up to 2 months in the wintertime. And it's a non-consumptive, it's product diversification is really what we're doing. And it allows us to use existing facilities and equipment, so it's just a really good fit for us.
All right. Well, good luck with the business, Gary, and thanks for joining me this morning.
Oh, thanks very much, Randy.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Gary Jabe is the owner of True North Safaris, and he runs McKay Lake Lodge in the Northwest Territories. Randy Henderson is with CBC Radio in Yellowknife. And you have been listening to The North This Week. You can find more stories from across the northern region of this country on our website at cbc.ca/north. If you want to get in touch, you can always drop us a line at dave_king@cbc.ca. And if you're in the north, why not tune us in on your radio dial? I'm Dave King. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.